This is Bill Blatter, and we have several people on the call. While we're waiting to get started, waiting for Jim to arrive, why don't some of you introduce yourselves and what you're hoping to get from the call this evening?
Hi, Bill. Michael Elliott here.
Okay, Michael, I'm glad you're here. Michael is with Rocket Dog Dental, and he'll sponsor this call. Why don't some of the doctors introduce themselves and what you expect out of this call this evening?
This is Jack Rochelle. I just thought I'd say hi.
And Jack, we're always very good.
It, so I thought I'd enjoy hearing this.
Well, what do you want to get out of tonight's call, Jack?
Well, I always get pearls of wisdom from you, Bill. So I guess just some good ideas for my practice.
Very good. Jack introduced himself. Are there some other doctors on the call that would care to introduce themselves and what you hope to get out of tonight's call? And we have Dr. Jim Burrell here from Green Bay, California, who has literally doubled his practice in the last few years. And today, he's one of the chapters in our Playing Your A-Game book. He's doing mainly large cases today, pretty much went from a general practice a few years ago, insurance-dependent, to what we'll find out tonight what he's doing. But well, Jim, why don't we get started? I don't know who's here. We have several people. We had almost 20 doctors signed up tonight, but as you know, doctors like to be lurkers and not say anything. And so why don't we go ahead and get started? We'll know they're listening, but they don't have any specific questions. Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice, the journey that you've taken since you've worked with us, and where you are, some of the things you've instituted in your practice that doctors would be interested in hearing about.
I'd be happy to. First of all, I just want to make sure, can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine. At least I can.
Okay, great. I practice just north of San Francisco in Green Bay, California, about 20 minutes north of San Francisco. I've been in practice for 28 years, and I've been associated with Bill for about 8 years now, 7 to 8 years. My practice is pretty much fee-for-service, insurance-independent. We do a lot of cosmetic cases. My mentors have been David Hornbrook, Mike Kozarski, John Coyce, Bill Dickerson. I currently have a team of four individuals. It used to be twice that many when I first met Bill. I practice 4 days a week. I work about 150 to 160 days a year. I take about 2 months of vacation a year. And I am probably more excited about dentistry now than I have ever been, for sure.
Well, Jim, I think that if I remember correctly, you've taken a lot of CE prior to working with me, but I think you took most of those people you've mentioned. You've taken more extensive courses since we started to work together.
Yes, certainly part of my experience. And, I mean, the journey never ends. My friend Mike Krasarski once said, where on the road to paradise are you going to stop today? I have a strong continuing education emphasis. I think it's really important to keep growing and keep learning, and certainly, choosing one's mentors, and be it a business mentor or a clinical mentor or a mentor outside of dentistry. I think there's a lot to be learned and gained from other people. I think, Bill, you probably said it once really well. You don't really have to. And when I first came into Blatchford Solutions, Blatchford Seminars, I felt very alone and isolated in my thinking. And Bill was nice enough to let me know pretty quickly that, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. A lot of people are doing things very successfully, and you can learn and copy and gain and mimic and be coached to whatever outcome you're looking for.
Jim, when you came into our program, now you're in California, and Delta in California has about a 70% market share. You are heavily insurance dependent. You made a comment a moment ago that you're pretty much insurance free today. And what does insurance freedom mean to you at this point?
Well, I'm really not dependent upon any insurance company to dictate my treatment or my treatment plan or the type of dentistry that I want to offer my clients. We've got a written vision and a written purpose. These were tools that were put into effect early in our relationship with people. And we read either the vision or the purpose every single morning, and that drives the direction of treatment. And those things speak to the quality of care. I'm not against insurance companies. I think they're great to have in place. But it's also wonderful to be able to deliver care to people and not be worried or dictated by some sort of insurance company. And having said that, I made a decision to leave Delta Dental before you and I ever met. And
I remember that.
I'm not sure if that's the wisest thing that, I mean, that was 8 years ago, and I think an individual practice, an individual situation needs to be really looked at and coached with someone who's got knowledge of the market and what's going on. I remember when you and I talked, we talked about there were two things that I think people need to be sure to be aware of if they're even giving any consideration to insurance independence. One is the volume of dollars produced by that insurance company as it affects your practice. And the second is the number of patients that comprise your patient base.
Yeah, the two separate numbers, if I interrupt for a moment, those are two separate numbers that you want to be aware of. Dr. Burrell had just dropped Delta Dental as a preferred provider, which means he's no longer bound by their fee structure. And, of course, Delta patients can still come to him as a non-provider. It's just that they now pay the same percentage, but of a usual and customary fee schedule. But he is not, and they pay the patient directly. So Jim collects from the patient, and they pay him. I remember this thing we were talking about that you were struggling with that, and I said, well, there are a couple numbers, and it's what you just mentioned. One is the number of patients affected. You need to know that number. And secondly, you need to know the amount of income that you're receiving from that particular insurance company. And then you, just for a rule of thumb, you just about want to double that because that's how much income is coming from those patients. But we can do a little more in-depth study on that to find out. But I know you had to really work on your presentation skills to show value when people were literally paying a higher fee and they weren't getting dentistry on sale anymore. I mean, they were paying full fee for it. So tell us some of the other things that you did to be able to survive, not only survive, I mean, you're producing more and considerably more now than you were with eight people. Now you're doing it with four, and you're doing it with 2 months off. And your fees are considerably higher today than they were. Even counting inflation, I mean, obviously in 8 years, fees would be considerably higher, but your fees are higher than in relation to other dentists in the area compared to before. What are some of the skills that you had to learn, you and your team had to learn to be able to do dentistry without Delta helping you?
I think you have to take a hard look at your situation and think about the outcome of what you're trying to achieve. I think you said it exactly right. It's the development of a skill set that allows you to develop that outcome. So if you need a clinical skill set to practice, say, for example, cosmetic dentistry, well, I mean, you can take one hotel class or read a journal or do something like that. I made a choice to work with David Hornbrook at then was PAC Live. And I went through the entire Hornbrook program faster than anybody ever went through it. So I hit it really hard. And after David Hornbrook, I went through John Coyce's program with equal zest. And so developing the clinical skill set to develop the goods, to deliver the goods, I think is really important. Now, having said that, it doesn't do you a heck of a lot of good to go out and get a lot of skills if you don't have communication skills, if you don't have your business skills, if you practice, for example, practice overhead. Employees are one of the number one overhead factors in a dental practice. And I went from eight employees down to three, and now it's back up to about four. And understanding the effects that those employees have on the overhead of the practice is important. Develop, for example, reading skill sets, reading books, putting things into place, scripting, learning how to talk and coach people.
Jim, let's go back and let me ask you a question here. When we started, you had eight employees. About what was your overhead in those days?
It was in excess of 80%.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the average is 75, so being an 80 is not terrible. What is it today?
52.
And I always know when a doctor tells me a number that close, 52, it's pretty darn accurate. What are the main areas? I mean, a lot of doctors want to know, okay, what can I do to drop my overhead? What are the main areas where you found them important to drop?
Well, certainly, employee cost was a huge factor. I mean, and looking at, you can look around your own community. I think the medical community is a great example. At least in our community, most medical offices are heavily overhead staffed.
And oh gosh, they're terrible.
Real huge effect on the bottom line. And first of all, I'd like to say, if there's any doctors, you know, that have questions, I want to be sure to field those too about this. And initially, it was very, very difficult for me because I had people working for me in excess of 15 years that I had part with, and we get very emotionally connected in long-term relationships with staff. But business is business, and friends are friends, and I think you have to learn how to separate those. And again, if you want to have run your office from a business standpoint efficiently, looking at employee costs is important. Having said that, you talked about other systems that affected that bottom line. My fee structure was way out of whack, and so I raised my fees, and I continue to raise my fees. And if people say, you know, your fees are quite a bit higher. I'll frequently tell people I am not the cheapest dentist in this community. Far from it. As a matter of fact,
I've heard some of your team members telling prospective patients that you're probably the most expensive.
Yeah, I kind of like them to know that coming in the door. I like the wow factor. I want my facility to speak to the direction that we're going. And when people come to our office, I mean, it's not pretentious, but they know it's not going to be, bottom of the barrel or cheap or on the cheap dentistry. And another mentor, Mark Montgomery in Portland, Oregon, you know, once said you have to draw your line in the sand somewhere.
Hey, now, Mark's been a client of ours. Mark was a client as well at one point. So let me ask you a question. What do you charge for a veneer in your practice at this point?
Our current fee for a veneer is $1,800.
18, uh-huh. What would you say the average in your area is?
For a veneer or a crown, it's probably around $1,000.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Probably about $1,000. You're at 18, so obviously.
18 is going up. It'll be raised by the end of February.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, today the mix of treatment you're doing in your practice, I know when you came to us originally, you wanted to do more high-end work. You wanted to do more cosmetics and more full mouth reconstruction. Today, what percentage of your practice would you say involved either cosmetics or reconstruction? And then percentage of your income?
Yeah. Oh. 80% or more. It's probably more than I look at it, when I look at the numbers, it's probably, it depends how you want to break it out, but it's got to be 80 to 85% of our income is coming from cosmetics and large case construction.
Jim, I know that you've worked with Rocket Dog, and Rocket Dog's one of our sponsors on the call tonight. Your overhead has gone down from 80 to 52, and yet you have a pretty good size outside marketing budget. What are some of the marketing things that you're doing? I know some of the doctors are always interested in the marketing aspect. What you're doing. I know you do a lot of internal. You do a lot of networking in the community. Your whole team does that. But why don't you just talk about some of the internal from the networking, and then let's talk about some of the external things you're doing.
Okay. As far as internal marketing goes, we track in the computer. We track numbers. We talk about 20 different numbers on a daily basis. And these are what we call our Blatchford monitors. It's in the computer. It's on a computer disk. Diagnosis numbers, I don't need to go through all of those, but one that we do track is called asking for a referral. So we expect all of our team members to actively ask for a referral every single day. And we target that in our morning staff meeting, and then we track it at the end of the day. So internal marketing, if you've got a client that you've done some great dentistry for and they're really excited about what you've done, they're a perfect client to try to, you know, let them know that you kind of enjoy doing this kind of stuff, and if they've got any friends, feel free to send them your way.
So you actually have some accountability with your team members. It's not just, hey guys, good idea to ask for a referral. You're actually following up.
Yeah, my staff is very accountable. They're very empowered. They make a lot of decisions on their own without having to be micromanaged. That's for sure. That's from leadership and leadership that I've been taught by you.
Tim, what else are you doing internally? You do a lot of spa amenities. You're doing, what are you guys networking-wise?
One of the things that I've found to be really helpful lately is getting referrals from other dentists. When you develop the skill set knowledge base, there's a lot of dentists that are just doing bread and butter dentistry. They don't want to tackle a cosmetic case. They don't offer in-house whitening. They may not even be doing veneer preparations in their practices. And as you develop a knowledge and skill base, and so we try to go out and have dinner. I personally have dinner with one dentist every single month in my community.
And that's so it's not just a matter of having the skill. You've got to go out and let people know you have that skill.
You have to let people know you have that skill. And that's both internally and externally. Another what I call a Burrell brother. I refer to people as Burrell brothers, which are people behind the scenes that my clients never get to see that allow me to deliver what's demanded of me and my vision and my purpose as it relates to the quality of care that I deliver to our clients. And the Burrell brothers is our marketing company, somebody like Rocket Dog, who I have a great relationship and a lot of respect for as far as our marketing program. I was meeting with Michael Elliott of Rocket Dog on a phone conference last week, and we were talking about our marketing strategies for 2008. You have to understand, in my community, there is very little dental marketing going on, and Marin County is a very affluent community. And it's kind of unusual. There's not a lot of guys that have been through cosmetic programs. There's very little marketing happening. And Rocket Dog has put together some really great materials. I've done an ad in a Marin magazine that has created a huge amount of buzz in my community. And one of the things we're looking at is direct mail. Now, historically, I haven't been a real fan of direct mail, and that's where I need to let my paradigms go. And I've learned this in dealing with you, Bill, and over the last 8 years. You have to be willing to think, thinking like a dentist, that, well, you don't understand, things are different for me. That's really not the case.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you mention that because, I think one of the things that we help doctors get past is, I learned a long time ago that, actually it's a quote from Socrates that I've followed for years, and he says, once you think you know something, you stop asking questions, and of course when you stop asking questions, you stop learning. And I think that's one of the things that we combat, all of us combat that on a regular basis. I mean, we find ourselves thinking we know something about a subject, and as soon as we start thinking we know something, we start making assumptions based on a false premise, and then, of course, we stop asking questions and we stop learning. And so I think that's one of the things that I admire in you is you've never stopped. Jim, you mentioned a reading list earlier or doing a lot of reading. How many business books do you think you've read in the last 5 years?
5 years? 150 maybe?
Probably 150.
Yeah. I'm reading one right now called... I've got one right now I really like called The Art of Woo, W-O-O.
I have that book. I've not started it yet, but I do have the book. And it's there's so much information out there, so many business writers and so many just great, knowledgeable people that have written these books. And what I find is amazing is most dentists haven't read them. And I asked in a seminar, I had, several hundred people in a room here a couple of weeks ago, and I started asking in the morning. And by the time I had them responding, so I knew they were responding. I started out, Jim, you've heard the story about my daughter at Nordstrom, where she read 9 sales books in the year she was there. So I always start with, how many have read 9 books? I'll give you your whole career, and usually get in a room several hundred, you'll get a few hands, but not many. And if you get a few, and I'll say, what you used to sell. In other words, when they had another career, they read these books. But a majority of the room has never read a single book on sales. When I say majority, I'm talking probably 75 or 80% have never read a book on sales. And I'm not just talking to staff members, I'm talking to doctors. And this is one of the things that I find in our clients, the you know, the Colleen Uletsky was in a seminar last week with us, and I think you've met Colleen and Jason there on that A-Book Audio. You know, and they produced $900,000 in the first 12 months opening from scratch with one employee. And Colleen has read 150 books in the last 2 years, and it's really hard. Jim, she's beaten us.
Yeah.
But unbelievable.
I think the thing, be it reading a book or being coached or advanced continuing education, sometimes we think these things are making our life more complicated or more difficult or it's not cost effective. But you know, having put some of these things in place, it really makes your life quite a bit more efficient and easier, certainly more profitable.
Well, you're only working 150 days, and I know those are about 7.5 to 8 hour days. So, Jim, tell us a little about your team. You said your team's empowered. I know they're bonusing, but what else have you done to empower your team? I mean, you've got a great group of people there.
Our team has bonused individually. They're getting triple figures right now. We work on a 15-day BAM cycle. We take the, well, it's not quite 15, yeah, because we're down to 150 days. So we, all of our cycles are the equal number of days, and they've been bonusing in triple figures, for the last 6 BAM cycles, maybe, 5.
So several hundred dollars a month.
Well, they're averaging somewhere between $800 and $1,100 a month.
Okay, very good.
In addition to their salary.
So they're making what? Somewhere an extra $12,000 a year? Would that be safe to say?
Safe to say.
I
think they're able to make, for example, if they have to make a purchase decision, one of the things that I've used is it's called make an executive decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I started this with all my employees a long time ago. If they come to me and they say, Dr. Bo, what do we do about this? Or where do we put this person? Or how do we go about doing that? And you know, I say make an executive decision. And we've talked about this in staff meetings. An executive decision is one that you're going to be accountable for and that you're going to own. And you have to understand that you're not going to do it. You won't get in trouble. You won't get fired. You won't be chastised. You're going to be encouraged to make decisions so that our practice runs efficiently and effectively. A lot of dental practices have to ask the doctor when to turn on the light switch, and
yes,
we don't do that anymore.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we've always worked on, and it's something that I've been a believer in for a long time, is that any employer will be asked to solve, will come up with solutions for problems, and any employer will learn very quickly that the team members can come up with problems faster than we can come up with solutions. And I have always thought that once we have a vision in place, turn the team loose, let them make decisions using the Nordstrom model of 4 rules. And that's what empowers people. And then, sure, they're going to make some decisions, but there's not a doctor in the country that hasn't made some bad decisions, too. We don't have any corner on ideal solutions. And I think allowing team to make decisions, and even if they make a wrong decision, they'll correct that decision faster than if you or I make a decision, Jim, that doesn't turn out right.
Well, and one of the things I learned from you, too, Bill, is that you once said, you know what, if they're not a 9 or a 10, they don't have any business working for you.
And that's a 9 or a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, and that's absolutely right. And if they're not a 9 or a 10, why do you have them? Because if we're gonna be a premier office, we need premier team members, and you can't do that with anybody. And, you know, you know Lou Holtz, and Lou Holtz says the best coach in the world can only raise somebody else's score by 1 point on that scale, 1 to 10. So anybody below an 8 is not going to make it. So absolutely. And if they're not a 9 or 10 after the first week, you know what to do.
Right.
And so, Jim, you were just talking a little bit earlier, too. Now tell us about your staff. Now they get a lot of time off as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're getting this, you know, the same 2 months off. Our hygienist just spent a month in Italy not too long ago. And, you know, I have one dental assistant, one front desk, one hygienist, and one rover who's doing clinical assisting phones. In fact, this rover, who is a dental assistant, she's pretty happy because recently, as you know, we've been talking about this program called Smile Reminder, which is using technology for emailing. By the end of the month, we're not going to be sending any more recall cards.
I think Smile Reminder is a great service, and I think they were just at our last two seminars. And what a great service, because you can eliminate all of those calls. And, you know, I was sitting in the medical office last week for about half hour, and the receptionist on the phone, and I noticed that about 90% of all the phones she made confirming, she was simply leaving messages anyway. And I talked to her about, why don't you do these by email or text messaging? And she said, wow, can you do that? And I said, yeah, most of my dental clients are doing that. And what a great service. It frees people up to spend more quality time with patients rather than on the phone in mundane clerical work.
Yeah, and I only have one dental assistant, but you have to understand, I only see one or two patients in the morning.
Yes.
Just a few patients in the afternoon because of the nature of the cases that we see. And I don't want to give the illusion that, you know, you have to be doing full-mouth reconstructions and smile designs on everybody that walks in the door. We're doing a level of comprehensive and quality care. And these are, you know, there's just skill sets that are learned from mentors such as, well, yourself or David Hornbrook or John Coyce, talking about the level of quality. There's plenty of dentistry to do in any dental practice to keep you busy.
Yeah.
My experience is that very few dentists are willing to draw their line in the sand and say, look, we're not going to tolerate occlusal or periodontal disease anymore or whatever, restorative disease. We're going to start taking a better level of care of people. And so now we've got, for example, one hygienist. I mean, she's using the diode laser on 99% of her patients. And she's had coaching from a hygienist up in Seattle that we employed to come down and show her how to use the laser and apply it to clinical applications. This hygienist also knows about clinical disease, aesthetic disease. These are people that have a level of awareness of what dentistry has to offer.
Jim, why don't you and I stop for a moment and let's ask if any of the doctors have any questions for you. We've covered a lot of material here this evening in a short period of time. Do any of the doctors have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Burrell? You have to hit the 6 button on your phone, unmute your phone, and then just ask your question. It takes a few seconds after you hit that 6 button for it to cycle through.
I have a question. I'm Dr. Kaufman. I'm from Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
Go ahead.
I just have a question for you about having such a low number of staff. Do you experience any problems, let's say, now you have a rover, but your assistant calls in sick or something like that, there's bad weather. Because my concern is with having a smaller staff, is not having any coverage,
yeah.
Having any like a safety net in case that something like that would happen.
Okay. So
Jim, you want to take that?
Sure. I can your question, Dr. Kaufman, is that, you know, when you get down to bare bones or a low number of staff, if someone were to call in sick, how does that impact the flow or affect the practice or that given day?
Correct.
First of all, if I've got my hygienist has not been sick in the 3 years that she's worked for me. Okay. She may not feel good on some days, but she's never called in sick. And also because of cross-training, if I were to have, let's say, a dental assistant call in sick, my front desk can serve a chair side. And because of the patient flow, and because everybody's pretty well cross-trained, I can almost run my office without a front desk. So I'm able to take that front desk person and put them at chair side. I did have a situation a couple of years ago where we had a dental assistant that had to leave our office, and I was without a dental assistant for 1 month because I was hoping that she would return, and she didn't. And so I worked 1 month without a dental assistant, and I produced $70,000 in that month without an assistant, and doing a lot of stuff by myself. Wasn't fun. I didn't enjoy it. My idea of the way to do things. But I guess my point is that we kind of focus on, well, if somebody's sick, what are we going to do? First of all, if you've got somebody that's routinely sick, they're no longer in my covenants and agreements. It says you're going to present yourself every day in the best possible physical shape to work. That's an agreement that we have, and we read those once a month. So if I've got, you know, a bad actor that's continuously sick or showing up late, that's not 9 or 10 behavior. And so I think we have to differentiate that between somebody who is occasionally sick, and if somebody's occasionally sick, that's an isolated event. It doesn't routinely happen. And we certainly have people who can fill in.
Dr. Burrell is covering this subject that we are very dear. I know we have Dr. Barry Turner on the, at least he was signed up to be on the call tonight, and he worked for several years without anybody at the front desk, and only recently has hired someone at the front. We, our typical clients work with small staff, so you know, that question comes up when we do our first seminar when we present working conditions, and somebody, I just love it when somebody says, well, what do you do about sick pay? And I says, there isn't any. Well, what do you do when you get sick? What I usually do at that point is I walk down the aisle, and of course, Dr. Burrell has seen me do this. I walk down the aisle and I call on each doctor and I say, when's the last time you missed a day for being sick? And what we come up with in the room is we come up with doctors have been there for years without missing a day for being sick. And yet if we have team members, and sometimes we laugh about the fact that they're being paid just enough not to quit and they're working just hard enough not to get fired. And those team members get sick on a regular basis. They don't show up. You put these teams together, you get them on a bonus system, and what happens is you start to get peer pressure. Somebody starts missing, and it affects the bonus for the whole team, and the team gets after them. And the team says, look, we need somebody we can count on. And, you know, we literally, this year, well, I mentioned we had one of these calls a few weeks ago with Jason and Colleen Valesky, a husband and wife team. Right out of school, they started a practice in Jacksonville, Florida. And they've had one person now. They just finished their second year in practice. The first year they did 870. The second year they did 970 in gross production. They're taking home well over half of that. But they just have one employee. And we call that person a resistant. She's been the same person for 2 years. She's paid real well. She's making an excellent income in that practice. And, of course, she gets all the paid vacation. And when I tell him in the dynamo, I said, we're going to work. Let's look at Jim's numbers. He just gave us his numbers. He works 150 days a year. So that literally leaves the team members 215 days a year to do whatever they want. They can go on vacation. They can get sick. They can take CE credits. They can do whatever they want. But the 150 we work, they show up. And we have systems in place. And the systems are stronger than employees. You know, my philosophy was, reinforced by my college roommate who flew in the Navy, flew off carriers in the Navy, and I said, what's it feel like to sit on a carrier, sit there in the cockpit of your jet ready to launch, and the thought goes through your mind, the last time the ship was in port, half the people that maintained that ship, the catapult and the aircraft, were changed. They're brand new. And his comment was, he said, you know, our systems are so good that we can change the entire crew and have all the confidence to sit there. And that's what we have to put in place in a dental office. I find in many dental offices, the systems really were brought by the current employees, and if somebody leaves, the systems go with them. And then we hire people that I joke about the fact with our clients, and of course I have to do this not in front of a room full of team members, but we hire incompetent people, we don't train them, and then we hire them a helper. And I don't believe that any dental practice or any dentist can afford to hire extra people on standby so when people are sick. I just don't think we can afford to do that. At least the clients I work with let me know that they can't afford to do that. So, yeah, you have worse weather up there in Sheboygan than we have than Jim has in California, but it's the same thing. I got off the phone this afternoon with one of my clients down in Kentucky. They had an ice storm, and he let me know that he says his whole team was there today. He said one was a half hour late this morning, but he was glad she got there safely, and they worked all day. And a few of their patients didn't show, but his team all showed up. And he was telling me that a few years ago,
a storm like this, he'd have people calling in, I can't get there today. And he said, of course, a few years ago, he had twice as many. So he works with three in a very similar practice.
I'd like to say something else about this, just to answer Dr. Kaufman's question, and then I'll, you know, field some more questions about this idea of being sick. First of all, one of the things we have, if you're sick, you don't get paid, number one. I know that may seem kind of hard, but when you're dealing with nines and tens, they understand that. And when they're getting large bonuses, they understand that. And there's also some, I don't want to say internal, but there is some peer pressure, or at least responsibility and accountability. If you're a member of a small team and you're all working towards a goal, and you realize that if you don't show up, that's going to have a direct effect on other people's bonus. There's a huge amount of responsibility that is just self-acquired by being part of that culture. And so there's a real difference there, is that you start to get people that want to come and work even when they might not feel 100%. Number two is that if someone isn't feeling well, we check in our morning meeting, which is about a 15-minute meeting. We have several meetings. We have a morning, evening, weekly, monthly meetings. But in our morning meeting, we're asking people if they're physically up to the task. And if anybody has any problems, we want to know about it so we can be there and support them and help them and nurture them throughout the day to make their day go easier.
Yeah, good. Other questions? Dr. Kaufman, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
A long answer from both of us, but true.
No, it's excellent.
Clients have good team members who don't miss work.
I do have another question, but I don't want to hog all your time. I'll wait and see if other people have a question.
All right, let's give somebody else a chance. Other questions from somebody else, and we'll come back to you.
Hi, this is Linda King from Georgia. I'm going to see you Saturday, Bill.
Yes, I know. I'm looking forward to it.
And I am, too. And I've got a question. I mean, going from eight staff members to four, I mean, who do you decide is expendable at that point? If you have, like, maybe three high tenants, and I mean, what was your staff makeup at that point? And I mean, I understand why you went from, you know, because the amount of restorative work that you're doing and the kind of quality that you're doing. But, you know, when you go from eight to four, I mean, what's the how many people, you know, were working in which areas?
It was Anna. Is that what your name?
Linda.
Linda, I'm sorry. I think, you know, that's a really critical and important question. I think that's a, you know, it's a really important, a very, very good question, particularly if you've got something like three hygienists going on. And at the time, I had two, and I'm down to one. And so I think this speaks to the importance of getting good coaching, because as the dentist is so emotionally and intricately attached to the practice, my perspective is sometimes skewed. You may say, for example, that you need three hygienists. You absolutely have to have three hygienists. If I were to come in and evaluate your practice, are they busy? What percentage are they busy? What's the number of no-shows? What's the quality and mix of treatment? And so when I looked at that in my practice, I realized that I could probably get by with one hygienist. Now, when I made that change, my personal mix of treatment changed as well. So I would be hopping between chairs and using expanded function dental assistants and tripping over people and falling down the hallway and, you know, huffing and puffing.
That wasn't that bad, Jim.
Yeah, it was kind of chaotic, I must say, because I had to, you know, keep both these dental assistants working and keep everybody flowing and patients coming in and out. And so when my mix of treatment changed so that I was doing a larger caseload, or I don't want to say, again, that it's just all cosmetic. It could be quadrant dentistry. It could be more thorough dentistry, more complete dentistry, larger case acceptance. Then you just don't need to see the numbers of people coming through the facility. You know, having said that, I mean, I've got a mentor, Mike Kozarski, up in Woodinville, Washington. He's got a staff of 15. So that's certainly different than four. So, and at 12 or 15, he would say that those are all 9s and 10s and essential people for his type of operation. So I don't always think that you need to go from 8 to 4. Maybe you go from 8 to 8 or 8 to 5 or 8 to 7. How do you know to make that decision? And that's the question that you just raised. How do you know which person is the person that you don't need?
Linda, in your particular case, we'll answer that question for you on Saturday. But the simple answer is we have a budget for each part of the practice, and the employees have to fit in the budget as well. And that's one of the biggest things that we find is that doctors are overpaying, not individuals, but they have too many people that their budget is out of control. So that's one of the things we look at. The other part is attitude. So it's good. Good question. We'll solve that Saturday for you.
I think the answer is you should have an outside perspective or somebody to take a look at it for you and give you their thoughts.
You know, one of the things that we have found is that almost every practice is over hygiene. That is, they have more hygiene time available than they actually have good patients filling it. Now, I didn't say there are patients there, but are they good patients? Are they people that ever accept any treatment? Or are they ones that miss appointments? You know, every third or fourth time they miss their appointment, don't show. So we take a look at all that. I call it titrating the hygiene department. So we'll be doing that for you on Saturday. Other questions from somebody else? Well, maybe we'll come back to Tim.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm Swoberlin from West Lafayette, Indiana.
Yes.
The four members that you have now, were they in your original eight, or did you have a complete staff turnover?
The four members that are there now were not there when I started with Bill 8 years ago.
That had to be difficult.
Yes, and no. Okay. It's always difficult to say goodbye to people that you've worked with for a long period of time. However, when you start to make some decisions as far as the direction that you're going to have your business take, and you've got people that have been there for a while, I'll give you an example. When I went to one of Bill's first programs, it was a Dynamo I found the workbook of one of my hygienists in the trash can on the way out. Well, that makes the decision pretty easy. I think that that can be the case, and certainly every practice is unique and different. And the ones that are really going to support you and are really behind you, they will rise to the occasion. They will shift their paradigm. They will have the energy and the desire to grow with you. So I don't think it's like, well, if I do something like get involved in a program such as this, it's going to mean that I'm going to automatically start losing employees. That's not necessarily the case.
Well, I think one of the things that we find out in the program is that we find out who's really committed. And listen, I'll go to the wall for anybody who's really committed to you. But what I find is that so many team members are not team members, they're staff members, is one of our clients. April Ziegler, who's the second chapter of our book, pointed out staff's an infection. And one of the things that I find so often is that these staff members are absolutely committed as long as they do it their way. And as soon as you start holding people accountable for results, as soon as you start asking them to learn a new skill, read a book, learn some new scripts, et cetera, their response is, hey, I'm not doing that. And so you find out real quickly, Don, that they're not as interested in our success as we would like them to be. And one of the things that Dr. Burrell said earlier is that, you know, you have to separate the two. Friends are friendship and business is business. And one of the things that we have found sometimes, and we've had a few doctors even do this, they'll put a wanted ad in the local newspaper or Craigslist to a blind response and find out that some of your own team members who were just absolutely, you just knew they were committed to you, are applying for jobs. And all of a sudden you say, whoa, they are looking for something else. As soon as somebody offers a little bit more money, and of course we offer them 6 to 8 weeks paid vacation and a bonus system and 4-day work weeks, and all of a sudden we find that some of the team members that we're actually working with are applying for this new job. And so we get that idea real quickly that maybe they're not as loyal to them as we are to as they are to us.
let's see. Somebody else, I think it was Tim, had another question you might want to ask.
Yeah, my question was, and I hope this isn't too specific to my situation, but this year I'm going to go on the first course for Hornbrook and also for John Coyce. But so I'm just at the beginning portion of what I consider ongoing curriculums of CE.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're doing more, I guess, bread and butter dentistry, single or double, two crowns at a time, that kind of thing. Nothing large. And Jim, you're doing these large full mouth reconstructions, and I can see how you could have longer appointments. But to make that transition, explain how that occurs to going from more simple, going from multiple rooms at one time to going to complex cases and advancing your practice that way?
Sure. First of all, say hi to both of those guys for me. They kind of changed my life, that's for sure. Be kind to yourself. These things don't happen overnight. They don't happen in a day. But I think as you go and learn from people, your diagnostic thinking, your skill thinking, your skill ability, your ability to deliver treatment, and in my case it happens to be cosmetic dentistry. It could be, you know, some other type of dentistry or implants or whatever. But I think, for example, John Coyce, John offers 9 courses up in Seattle. I got to tell you, once you've gone through those 9 courses, your thinking and approach and diagnosis and treatment planning change. And so you start to appreciate a different level of care given. That being said, there's other things that are critical to those people receiving that care. For example, a new patient, the first phone call to your office from a new client is a critically probably one of the most important interactions that client is going to have with your office. How is that phone call handled? What types of questions? How is that person led down to the next step? So if your goal is to really deliver dental care to folks at a certain level, other systems must be in place. Financial systems, how people pay for cases, these types of things have to be taken care of, or else you're going to these classes and you'll come home frustrated. You'll say, you know, I know that I should be doing this, but I'm not, and I'm feeling less than. And, you know, I didn't spend a bunch of money to go hear David Hornbrook or John Coy and fall asleep in these classes and come home and not put up to work. These courses, or Bill Blatchford or Rocket Dog or whatever it's going to be, I can tell you for sure, they all pay for themselves many, many times over. But what it demands of you is to put what they're saying into effect and not come home and sit on your backside and say, yeah, but my operation is different. Yeah, but...
Well, Jim, I think you summed it up very nicely, and I think the other thing is that, you know, so many doctors spend so much time and money. They go to these clinical courses, and then they come home and they try and reinvent the wheel and try to do the practice management and the leadership side on their own, and they go down so many tunnels without cheese at the end that they get frustrated. And, of course, I find them about that point where they've been to all these courses, and yet they're not doing these large cases. And you know, I've sat in both of the courses you've mentioned enough times, and people come up and say, well, how do you get a patient to do this kind of stuff? And that's really the key, as you said, the way the phone call is taken care of, the way they're talked to, and all that sort of thing. And it's a real shift. And remember that a lot of these top clinical instructors, you know, half their patients are dentists, and so they're not dealing with the same patients the rest of us do. Well, I want to thank Dr. Burrell for being on this call tonight. I want to thank Michael and Rocket Dog. I want to thank, I know some of my people are on the call, and a number of doctors here. You're taking some time out of your evening. All of you will be contacted by one of our people, one of our enrollment counselors, and I would like you to at least return the call.
I know some of the people on the call are in our program, and Linda, I'll be seeing you on Saturday in West Palm Beach. We're looking forward to that. And we'll answer that question for you Saturday, so we'll get that dealt with. And But for the rest of you, you know, at least return the call and get more details about your specific situation and see if what you have going is a mix for what we do. We only take about 50 clients a year, and so we're somewhat selective, but we're anxious, too, to help doctors have a better life. And to me, it's all about balance of life. It's not just about your practice. And while we didn't talk about that tonight, that's one of the things that Dr. Burrell has mentioned several times, is life is a lot more fun when he's not as well. He's certainly, I don't want to say you're not focused on dentistry, Jim, because you certainly are, but you certainly you know, you were working somewhere close to 200 days a year when we started, and now you're down to 150, and your net has gone up dramatically. And you're having a lot more fun, and you're looking forward to going to work. I find so many doctors are not looking forward to going to work. As a matter of fact, they call it work. And that's one of the things that we like to work on, is creating a practice that supports your life. And so there's really not as much distinction between what you do for a living and who you are. So that's one of the major emphases. So thank you very much for being on the call tonight. Jim, again, thank you very much. I know you want to go hear Art Dagone speak tonight. So have a nice evening. Everybody, have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.